Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Diane Johnson, whose latest book is Le Affaire, also the author of several other novels, including Le Divorce, which recently became a film, and biographies of Dashiell Hammett and Mary Ellen Meredith, the wife of George Meredith, screenplay writer, particularly The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's film, travel writer, essayist, book reviewer, and at this point, chronicler of Parisian or French-American relations on a subtle level, which is what Le Affaire is about and what the two previous books, Le Mariage and Le Divorce, are about. Now we've got a trilogy. Before we get into it, are you planning to continue this trend, or is this the trilogy?
I think this is the trilogy. I don't think there's a word for quadrology or whatever four books would be, quarto. But I can't promise because I'm still living in France, and so I keep seeing things, and French-American relationships keep changing, too, in pretty fascinating ways. So who knows? I might strike again.
Le Affaire takes place partly in Paris, but mostly in the Swiss Alps, in a ski resort there, and involves, again, Americans, Parisians. Now you brought in a German baron as well as several people from England, which creates the additional relationship between the English and the Americans and the English and the French. When you began work on this, was that your intention to kind of continue with this and just throw more into the mix?
Yes, especially the relationship between the English and the French got to seem pretty fascinating to me. And then also the whole phenomenon of Eurotrash. I was very complimented in a way when one of my children was heard to say to one of her friends, "I think Mom and John are becoming Eurotrash." And I thought, yes, Eurotrash. That is a whole contingent that I haven't really been thinking about.
Well, let's define Eurotrash, because we all hear the term, and I love the term. It's so great. What is Eurotrash?
Alas, I probably will never be able to qualify, because I think you have to have a title, no money, a permanent suntan, wonderfully capped teeth. I think all of the women are blonde, and they hang out in places like Megève or the Riviera and don't do much of anything until they die on a speedboat or on a motorcycle or something like that.
And they get mentioned in society columns.
And they get mentioned in, yeah. But the trashier sort of society columns of the Sunday paper,
Le Affaire deals with several characters interacting. At the heart of it, though, is something very serious, which is the relationship of laws between multiple countries. In particular, here we have inheritance laws. When you began working on this, was that your starting point, or did that suddenly come about after you began
the book? No, you spotted that it was the starting point. I became very interested in the difference between Anglo-Saxon inheritance laws, generally, for which the English stand in this novel, and the French, in that the French Napoleonic inheritance laws are very focused on the family in the way, our inheritance laws, you can go crazy on your deathbed and leave everything to the cat's home or something. And you can do whatever you want with your money. At some level, that seems as it should be to us. And at some level, of course, we all know of the terrible disasters and injustices when the doddering grandfather runs off with the au pair girl and leaves everyone high and dry. In France, the children will always get a certain percentage of every estate. So everything is left in the family, and the family is really the emphasis, and the family fortune is thought of as something that should be transmitted to the children, and you can't disinherit your children, which, if we had that small provision in our society, there wouldn't be all the deadbeat dads, and there wouldn't be, there'd be a whole solvent above the poverty level order, which we don't have now.
Without giving too much of the story away, because the story is really about people. This is just kind of a clothesline to hang some clothing
on. Well, it's a way of getting them all to the ski resort.
There's a scheme to involve a man in a coma and get him from France to England in order to change the inheritance laws. But as I'm reading afterward, that didn't seem to make any difference. It wouldn't have made any difference, or would it have?
I think it would have. In the book, he dies in England. And so what some of the people involved were hoping was that the English laws would or wouldn't take precedence. because if in English law he'd left it all to his youngest infant son. If he died under French in France, all of his children would have gotten some of his fortune. But then the reality was that between France and England, there are negotiations, and France prevails when his property was in France. So actually that was an inconvenience to my plot when I discovered that that was the case.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. But that changes it anyway, because it just brings in new complications.
New complications, yeah.
Several characters who interact with one another. The primary character is a woman from Palo Alto who goes over there to get a makeover. She's a multimillionaire. Question I had concerned the timing of the book. It's clear toward the end of the book that it takes place in the winter of 2002. Yet I was wondering, because early on she's a dot-com wizard, and at one point she wonders if she's losing her money, and I kept thinking if this had taken place a year earlier, she would have lost her money while she was in France.
Well, that's right, but that had to be fudged a little as the stock market plummeted while I was writing the novel. So somewhere I say that she had cashed out her options and put them, we have to assume, in something pretty safe.
But I was thinking, what would have happened halfway through the book if she suddenly found out she was broke?
Well, that would have been interesting, but it didn't interest me as much, because the ostensible reason, one of the reasons she was there, was to learn to be rich. She was still in the process of learning to be rich, and if she'd lost her fortune at that point, she would just have gone back to being where she started, and there almost would be no drama.
Several other characters are there, one of which, Antoine de Persand, who's an attorney, pops up in both Le Divorce and Le Affaire. He is the brother of the husband getting the divorce in the first book and pops up in the second. I think there's mention of one of the characters from the second book, Sophie Anne, I think is mentioned.
And also the woman novelist, Estelle Dargel, who is also mentioned. She comes to a party or something. I would like to keep a sense of this all being the same world.
Did you go to the French Alps and stay at a resort similar to that and look at the terrain?
Yes, I have every year for about 20 years been spending at least a week skiing in the French Alps. And so I thought it high time to use this wonderful setting.
There's an underlying political element to the book, to Le Faire, Diane Johnson. And we see it at times more in the way Amy's friend in Palo Alto tells her that, are you sure you're safe? They're not out to kill you over in France. And that made me wonder. I spoke with you in August of 2001. Had you left for France in September, when September 11th happened?
Yes. I had just, yeah, exactly. And so at the time that we talked, we had no sense of this impending catastrophe.
And you were in France at the time.
So I was in France at the time, yeah. Le Monde's headline said, "We are all Americans." The mood was extremely sympathetic, supportive, concerned. They realized to what extent they too were vulnerable in the sense that they have the same set of enemies. The sympathy that America has lost between now and then is dramatic, but individual Americans have not suffered from French animosity at all. They still go out of their way to say, nous sommes anti-Bush, nous ne sommes pas anti-américains. We're not against individual Americans, but we sure do hate George Bush. And that's a pretty general European, perhaps worldwide, feeling now.
Do they hear about things like freedom fries, which I actually stumbled on once in Hawaii.
Did you?
I was appalled.
That is appalling. I thought maybe they were apocryphal, some sort of congressional joke. Anything like that they hear about. And they were astonished. The thing that astonished them most, of course, was reports of French wine being dumped down the sink. That did astound them.
This is pretty much a general feeling in France about Bush, and it does not translate toward Americans. So when you're over there, it's more or less the same typical anti-Americanism in quotes that we find in your three books.
Yeah, exactly. The mood hasn't really changed, and I'm not sure that I would say anti-Americanism even, because they always make exceptions for the Americans they know or their American relatives or whatever. It's just a kind of historic, as it turns out, attitude that the French and certainly the English, too, have had since the Revolution.
There's also a lot of reference to Prince Kropotkin and his philosophies. Where did you stumble on Kropotkin?
I actually was given his book, his great book, Mutual Aid, by Carolyn Kaiser. You probably know Carolyn, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. And for some reason, she thought that I needed to read that book. Maybe something I was talking about or something. So anyway, I was unaware of Prince Kropotkin until then.
He has a philosophy of community is more important.
Yeah,
than
he's kind of proto-socialist or proto... Technically, he called himself an anarchist and was part of the anarchist movement in Russia before 1917. But a very endearing figure, and he has the theory set forth in Mutual Aid that successful species, it's not exactly Darwinian. It's not competition of the fittest that enables people to survive, but cooperation.
When you're writing a book like this, how clear is your outline, or do you just kind of put up impediments and see where it takes you?
In this book, a little of both. I try to have an outline. I try to see as much as I can in advance. But this was unusually resistant to outlining, and I had to kind of understand it as I was going along the more I got into it. I think partly because of the turbulence of actual history. While I was writing it, things kept changing so dramatically. I began it before September 11th, 2001. And you can imagine how dramatically that changed everything. And one of the main ways, there's a character called Emil, who's a North African but a Maronite Christian or something. But originally he was a Muslim, a North African, say Tunisian or Moroccan, rising in French society. I just backed off that because it was almost going to be too complicated.
As the book goes along and as the characters begin to interact, we get the sense the Diane Johnson examination of the two cultures meeting. And I'm curious, how much of this is your own specific experience? Did you take cooking classes?
Well, I did. I took cooking classes at the hotel that I'm writing about, the prototype of the Hotel Croix Saint-Bernard. I also went to the Ritz Cooking School, which was founded by somebody from around here, actually.
There's a comment that's made, and I wonder if it was actually a real comment about some woman, and I'm misquoting it, but something like, she can bake a marvelous souffle, but she can't boil an egg.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the kind of product these schools turn out. All these young women who are sent off, young European, you know, princesses and things, sent off to the Cordon Bleu to learn these marvelous dishes, and then they entertain so wonderfully, but I'm not sure they can boil eggs.
Amy finds some linens, and she spends a lot of time wondering how the hell they possibly could have been ironed because they're so thick and heavy. I assume that these are real observations.
Absolutely,
for you.
Yeah. And I haven't found out how you iron them. There is a place in Paris, a special boutique, where people send their linens from all over to be washed and ironed if they are these historic linens. And there's a man in Switzerland near Basel, with whom I'm in correspondence, who is at a kind of textile institute and gave me such information as what tablecloths like Amy's would cost.
Diane Johnson, let's move on to a film called The Divorce. You said before we went on the air that you were moderately involved in this film.
Only in the sense of hanging out, watching some of it be filmed. It was filmed in Paris on locations, and so I would go and watch the filming from time to time. And if I was there, they might ask me, what kind of poem would you be reading at this occasion? Or if there was some detail that had to be added that wasn't in the book, then they might ask me. But only in that very happenstance sense was I involved. But still, it made me identify with the whole process. And
were you there at Alain Ducasse when they filmed that scene?
No. Alas.
I think Sam Waterson says $900 for five people, and I'm thinking they got off cheap.
Yeah, I know. That's another one of these things that changes by the time you get done with, by the time the ink is dry, as the saying goes.
You're listening to an interview with Diane Johnson, whose latest book is L'Affaire. During our discussion before we went on the air, we talked about some of the problems with the film, and I enjoyed it and you enjoyed it, but I kept thinking it should have been, could have been a much better film.
Well, yes, I guess of what film can that not be said? And we were touching on some of the things that I had wished were different. I had great questions about the age of Uncle Edgar, who's a man of 70, a portly, white-haired, handsome man of 70, sexually vigorous and so on in Le Divorce. But the Uncle Edgar in the film is Thierry Lhermitte, a very attractive and very famous French actor of maybe about 50. But one of the problems Merchant Ivory had was finding a French actor who looked the part and could speak English well enough to be understood. Apparently that is not so common and not so easy to find. And then also he had to be plausibly somebody that a young woman would sleep with, so he had to be in pretty good shape. And so all of these limitations reduced the pool very much. So finally Jim Ivory said, well, Diane, you'll just have to get used to it. Anyway, we can't have those hairy white backs on camera. I never did find out if they were asking elderly French actors to take off their shirts to see how they would film. But anyway, finally, Thierry Lhermitte is a little different than I had imagined at Uncle Edgar. But people who had no presuppositions about it seemed to say that they think he's fine. So.
And Kate Hudson.
And Kate Hudson, again, she wasn't quite maybe the Isabel that I had in mind. Roxy is perfectly the Roxy that I had in mind. Naomi Watts is the perfect Roxy. I'm not sure what could have been done differently, how Kate could have been instructed differently, because she had her own ideas, and this was very much her version of Isabel. So I think finally Jim Ivory just let her be Isabel, and she's Isabel suitably. Lots of people love her performance.
I thought the editing was too loose. You thought it was too tight.
I thought that there were constraints on John Allen, that mainly of time, that made them kind of curb scenes that I thought should have rolled out their natural length, or I could have happily sat and watched. For instance, there's a marvelous scene where the mother, the American mother, who's Stockard Channing, mother of Isabel and Roxy, finds herself alone in a room at the country house of the French family, and suddenly she's surrounded by Leslie Caron and the actress who plays the wife of Isabel's lover, Uncle Edgar. And these two women sit down and they say ever so sweetly, now that we're so intime, we think that we can speak to you frankly as mothers and as friends. Well, I would have loved that scene to go on until Stockard Channing hears about the affair between Isabel and Uncle Edgar. But as it is, it stops there, which is tantalizing, and then we don't learn until on the train what Stockard Channing feels about this development, if I'm explaining this clearly. You can defend that version of the editing, too, I think.
There's one other thing about the film, which is that despite an extraordinary cast, it was marketed as an art film, and that limits its distribution, so it will never be seen in many communities. And it's odd that when it finally disappears from theaters, which I would assume it will have by the time we air this, it will have made less money than Geely, that horrible Ben Affleck film.
Which was considered a great failure.
Yeah, and the reason for that is because Geely opens in 3,000 theaters, yeah, plays for 2 weeks, and Le Divorce opens in 500 and plays for a month and a half and can't earn that money back.
I don't know. I'll never understand the financial calculations of studios. And they were absolutely delighted. Fox was delighted with how it was doing. So, beats me. It was quite a low-budget picture, so they didn't have to make that much back. But as you say, Julie probably took in more on the first day or something.
Did you see the screenplay before?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you make any comments at that time?
Well, I did, because it had an ending that I was very sort of upset by. In Ruth Prower Jobvilla, James Ivory's script, they have Isabel getting pregnant, and then Uncle Edgar sort of behaving like a cat and saying, get rid of it, and that precipitating their breakup, and then Isabel going off into the sunset to bear her child happily. You know, it's not treated as a tragedy, but even so, it was such a wrong tone and unneeded complication and bizarre invention. The only thing I could think of was that Ruth Power Javola was thinking of Howard's End, or thinking that this was E.M. Forster or something. So I did really complain about that, and so did the film editor, and then luckily so did the Fox executives.
You worked with Stanley Kubrick. You wrote the screenplay for The Shining, and you continue to know Stanley Kubrick up until his death, right?
Yes.
When we spoke in August of 2001, AI had come out, but you had not seen it. Have you seen it?
I still haven't seen it.
So you still can't comment on it. Why haven't you seen it?
I don't know. I think kind of dread. I don't know if it's that I didn't want to have to think about what was the Spielberg element, what was the Kubrick element, or people said it was sort of a trying film, and I don't know.
When we talked last time, Eyes Wide Shut had just come out, and we discussed that, and you mentioned that you felt that the flaw in the film was that it was set in contemporary times.
Yes, I still feel that more and more, because since we talked, though, I've thought more about what, or I've come to understand the film, I guess, a little more. So I don't know if I said this when we talked about it, but the schnitzler is a dream, a man's dream, and in the dream, it's a sort of psychic archetype of male sexual anxieties and wishes and so on, the kind of the libido of a man. And in Schnitzler's time, when it was written, this was relatively unexplored territory and therefore interesting for the writer to explore, and if there had been films then, for the filmmaker to explore. And it was this strange continent of, you know, of male sexuality that I think drew or fascinated and kind of repelled Kubrick. He was never sure whether it was a comedy or a tragedy and so on. But certain things since Schnitzler's day are perfectly well understood, that women have sexual desire, which is quite shocking in the story and perhaps to Schnitzler, because it was very much a period when women were thought not to have sexual desires. So if it had been set back then, we could all allow for that. We know now, and no character, no husband would be surprised that his wife has an erotic dream about another man. Something like that might not please him, but he wouldn't be surprised the way he was in Schnitzler in the Kubrick film. I just think to have made that clear, that clearer that it was a dream and a dreamscape, and that it was in this other period. So, for instance, I'm sure I was very hard on the orgy when we talked about it before, because I didn't immediately understand that the orgy is a kind of banal orgy full of the very most banal symbols of orginess, because those were the archetypes of sin and wild sexuality and so on, furnished to the unconscious of a person of that period. And then because symbols become outworn, now they've moved on.
Why do you think Kubrick, knowing all this, still set it in contemporary times?
Well, I think I can think of two explanations. And one is the kind of popular appeal explanation, which was either imposed on him by Warner Brothers or even was his own idea to maybe update it and make it seem more relevant. And the other was that he himself just wasn't that clear about the meaning of what he was doing. But I'm sure he was clear about it, because the fact that the New York signs, you know, Kubrick was a stickler for realism. Everything had to be plausible. So he would never have a character who had endless bills in his billfold for whatever financial, that's the kind of thing that happens in a dream. So his signals that this was a dream were very, very clear. I think it's maybe only the first explanation that I believe, that is that Warner Brothers made him do it.
You talked to Kubrick fairly regularly in the period after the making of The Shining?
Well, less and less over the last few years. And he talked to everyone less and less. A lot of former friends who said the same thing, that he hadn't returned their fax or phone call.
What other films was he thinking of making? Do you have any idea?
No, I really don't, actually. This Eyes Wide Shut was the film that was most preoccupying to him during the period that I knew him. And then he had some things that he never had quite let go of, like his Napoleon film, but that he didn't, I don't think he had any clear intention to make. There was a kind of ghost story which a woman, whose name I forget, a woman novelist, English, said she wrote a treatment or a version of for him during the period that he was working on Eyes Wide Shut. So what that would have been, I'm not sure.
In looking back on his films as a whole, is there any film that you think is really underrated?
He's probably received the praise that is owing to him. Each time I see one of his films, I like it a little better. I just recently saw Lolita, and I'm almost afraid to see Dr. Strangelove. It's got to be so relevant, huh?
What about Barry Lyndon?
Barry Lyndon was definitely underrated, it's true. I don't know that it's found its, but it has its passionate supporters. I haven't seen it in a while.
Neither have I. It's one of the most gorgeous movies, if
absolutely.
I recall correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. Full Metal Jacket, we'll see how time will treat that. It has that problem of the two stories. The Shining was underrated for a while, and it seems to have gone on and on.
Well, a horror story which doesn't really scare you.
I think he hoped that it would scare people, but that it would be intellectually respectable. He didn't want there to be any trashy blood and gore knives coming out from behind picture frames and the kind of Halloween kind of manipulative scary. It needs to be psychological horror kind of mixed with the supernatural.
Diane Johnson, another area to talk about, your work in biography. On your biography of Dashiell Hammett, I read that you worked closely with Lillian Hellman on that. Is that correct?
Well, I was sent to Lillian Hellman for her papers and her reminiscences, and so I didn't really work with her, but she was supposed to make herself available. That was one of the conditions that Random House put forth in hiring me to do that job. It was a job, basically.
Did you get a sense of Lillian Hellman in your meetings with her?
Oh, well, I guess, yes, definitely.
What was she like?
Well, she could be very charming and very funny, but she went surrounded by so many warnings by everyone that knew her that you couldn't but be a little bit on your guard that she was going to do some terrible thing to you. And indeed, she was very difficult. She threatened to prevent the book from being published. She absolutely hated it, and she threw up all kinds of obstacles. But at the same time, her health was failing. And
in your meetings with her, though, this was after
then she
that.
Was always very charming, absolutely.
And your biography of Mary Ellen Meredith, that sounds more like a labor of love.
That was a labor of love. It was sort of I was in graduate school at the time and working on my dissertation, and that was sort of a spin-off from my dissertation, which was on the poetry of George Meredith, which is how I came to know about his wife.
And what was her relationship with him then?
Well, she was the heroine of some of his novels and of his poem sequence, Modern Love. And then they fell out or grew apart or something. She went off with a minor pre-Raphaelite, Henry Wallace. And then she died. And I guess what drew me to the whole subject was the way that was treated in Meredith's biography, as though there was some connection between her death and her adultery in the fashion of a Victorian novel. So I just thought, well, I'll bet she had a story to tell of her own, and hence the book's title, Lesser Lives.
When you're doing a biography of someone who is not that famous and has their own life like that, how hard is it to find the information, particularly of a woman in that era?
Well, it was very hard, and that is a whole story that someday I should write, you know, an article about or something, because it was great fun. And it took me through all the orthodox steps of the record offices and birth and, you know, church registries and so on. But also then I met the heirs of Henry Wallace, with people in Purley, Surrey, and finally found her letters to Henry Wallace under their bed in a paint box. You know, they said, look in here. This is where we put Uncle Henry's stuff. And so there was that thrilling, heart-pounding thing of finding treasures that nobody else had ever looked at. Every biographer who has that experience can affirm that there's nothing like your quest being rewarded by, you know, these wonderful, thrilling discoveries.
It sounds like a scene out of A.S. Byatt's Possession, actually.
Well, it was very like that, absolutely. And one of the reasons I loved that novel, it brought so much back of hunting for Mrs. Meredith.
When you're writing a biography and the information is so scanty, even when you find it, it's kind of ephemeral. It's there but not there. How much do you want to extrapolate from that and try to put pieces together, try to connect dots that may be almost like jumping a chasm that you can't jump?
Well, I was very conscious of having to do that in Lesser Lives, and so I signaled very strongly when I was doing that with italics or with some setting up of the scene that indicates that it's an imaginary reconstruction.
What happens when you're dealing with somebody whose life is known, like, say, Hammett?
In the case of Hammett, my technique, because I found that his letters, which I had access to, were, in fact, very bland, not very revealing, cheerful, hardly heart-rending, was I just used them, quoted from them amply, did not insert myself or any kind of speculation at all, except in the footnotes, where I did have some interesting things to add, but didn't ever put them in the text, which is more or less a biography from Dashiell Hammett's own point of view.
And maybe that's why Hellman didn't like it.
Yeah, it is part of the reason. The reason she said was there wasn't enough about her in it. And I said, but Lillian, he didn't meet you till his life was half over. He was 40-something. She said, yes, but I came into it before I came into it.
So. Still, it keeps, whenever I hear Lillian Hellman's name, I keep hearing, I read a couple of biographies of Leonard Bernstein, and he always referred to her as Uncle Lil.
Yeah. So he was one of her young men. She had a circle of devoted guys, sort of in that same set, of which Leonard Bernstein was definitely one.
Diane Johnson, now you've written the third book in your French series. Have you begun work on another novel?
No, I haven't. I only finished this one in June, actually. It's a miracle of speedy publication because the publisher thought it would be nice for it to come out more or less at the same time as the film. And I'm sure that's true. But as a result, I've hardly had a minute to imagine writing another novel.
It sounds as if you're pretty much done with this French-American connection.
Well, I'm just worried about tiring people out. I don't know how I would move back to America. Maybe I have to go to Africa or somewhere, some distant place, the Balkans or something.
Now, you've also done travel writing.
Yeah.
Have you done that recently?
No, nothing. I have been collecting a few pieces, which are going to be a book kind of like my book of travel pieces, which was called Natural Opium. This one is going to be called Men on Top, I've decided. And it's not by places, but by category of men. But it'll allow me to skip around. For instance, one category would be directors, so that I can put down some of the things I remember about Kubrick, about Francis Coppola, I worked with him.
What you work
about
with?
Merchant Ivory. Well, I worked with him for a year on a very elaborate project, which was to be called Cure, about the science, the search for the cure for AIDS. And it was great fun, actually. And then, I don't know, just about then he turned to winemaking.
And Merchant Ivory.
Merchant Ivory, then working with them. And I once wrote a script for Sidney Pollack, another for Volker Schlondorf, another for Mike Nichols.
What was the film you worked on for Nichols?
It was going to be a remake of Grand Hotel. Apparently, MGM over the years has constantly commissioned new Grand Hotels. And ours was going to be set in the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas. And then it burned down. It was going to have Dolly Parton. I think it would have been wonderful.
Diane Johnson, After the success of Le Divorce, any chance that Le Mariage or Le Affair will become films?
Well, I would be thrilled if so. Well, just keep your fingers crossed, and I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Would you want to write those screenplays?
No, not particularly.
Because?
Just because I've finished with them in my heart. I actually wrote a screenplay for Le Divorce for the first people who bought it, from whom Merchant Ivory bought the rights. And I enjoyed that process. It was with Michael Schiffer, who's a screenwriter and producer. And that was fun, and it doesn't take that much time because, of course, you know the material. But on the other hand, it wasn't a new creative adventure either.
You've been listening to an interview with Diane Johnson, whose latest novel is Le Affair. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.